I'll tell you what I want to talk about this evening. I want to work with the text. First of all, those of you who know me know I always prefer texts. I'm not going to ask anyone to read. I will do the reading. But a text study does something. First of all, it can provide us with a message. But I think it does something else. It should arouse among us a respect for a text. These people were serious scholars who knew how to write and knew how to project ideas. And they make us work for it. There is no way that you can read a story in rabbinic literature, as we will read today, three, and sort of superficially draw the message that they are trying to impart. You really have to work for it. And I'm going to show you today how I think we can approach a text and work with a text. I won't keep it too long. I know we're all tired after a month, and if I should yawn in the middle of this talk, it's not because I'm tired at all, but because I've heard this before. There is a type of story that reappears a number of times in rabbinic literature, and it usually goes like this. A Gentile, and my message has to deal to a major extent with our attitude towards others. A Gentile approaches a noted rabbi and asks him a question relating to Jewish practice and belief. And usually it's a very central question. It doesn't deal with some insignificant element, but with a major problem. And the rabbi answers the Gentile. And it appears that the Gentile is satisfied, in most cases, with the answer. And then goes off. Whereupon the rabbi's disciples approach him and say, "Master, him you dismissed with a reed, but what is your reply to us? We know that the answer you gave him, they seem to suggest, was flimsy. You put him off. But what's the real answer?" Now, of course, the fact that they make that statement already says something very interesting. That the question was a real question and deserves a real answer. The disciples claim that the answer that the Gentile received may not have been the real answer. And then the rabbi gives them a second answer. And this raises all sorts of questions. Are there really two different answers? Do you speak differently to Gentiles than you do to Jews? Do you hide the truth from a Gentile and give it only to your Jewish students? What do these stories seem to imply? Are there two different truths in understanding the Torah? Is the truth that he gave the disciples truer than the truth that he gave to the Gentile? Does the second answer cancel the first one? These are serious problems because it goes to the essence of how we try to project ourselves to others. Does the story imply that we can project ourselves to others not quite in a factual and honest way? That we have an inside answer and an outside answer? And so you realize the issue is serious. I collected all of these examples, and I think that I was able to crack open the secret, the code. Now, of course, my solution only works with some of the examples, and those are the ones I'm going to teach today in good scholarly fashion, right? It doesn't work with all of them. But it works with a sufficient number to have convinced me that this is a phenomena that reappears a number of times. And so together with you, I'd like to teach these sources, and then we'll ask the questions. I'm going to ask you questions during the reading as well. Each and every source, I'm going to ask questions, so you have to follow me very carefully. The first story deals with a well-known biblical custom that apparently came into disuse after the destruction of the Second Temple. And that is the law of the red heifer. What is that? Red heifer, the red cow, right? Or heifer, H-E-I. Heifer, slicha. Yeah. The story is, a man becomes impure, ritually impure. How does he purify himself? He came into contact with a dead body. We are told that there is a system for purifying him. You take this cow, you slaughter it, you burn it, rub it into ashes, put the ashes in water, sprinkle the water, a priest sprinkle, or somebody designated sprinkles the water on the impure person. The impure person waits until sunset, and he becomes pure again. It looks very magical. In fact, it's so strange that this became the example in rabbinic circles for asking a very important question: is there any intrinsic explanation for mitzvot, for commandments? Can we understand the nature of commandments? And the example that is always given is this example, because it seems to be so strange that the rabbis themselves say, how do we understand this? What's the logic? Is there logic? And you know that they gave a number of different answers. One answer is, yes, there is logic, but only Moses could know. In fact, the language in Hebrew is, V'yikhu, God tells Moses, V'yikhu elecha para aduma, they shall take to you this red heifer. And the rabbis say, to you, only you, Moses, will understand it. The rest of the people, for them, it's a commandment. Other rabbis would say, there is an internal reason, and you have to really dedicate yourself, and you'll crack open the code. A third branch of rabbi says, there is no internal reason. It is a commandment, and you are to obey, and the height of obeying is when you don't understand what you're doing. You are doing it, you were commanded to create discipline, just the way those of you who, like me, were in the army will remember this. When your sergeant would tell you to sweep up the parade ground in a desert from all the sand on the parade grounds. And you know you can't clean the parade grounds. It is an impossible task, but he tells you to do it nevertheless. You don't understand why he's telling you to do it. It makes absolutely no sense. But of course, what is he trying to achieve? He commands and you do, and that's the point. And God is the great sergeant. So this particular commandment is very unique, and clearly it makes sense that a Gentile would say, what are you guys doing? Now let's read the story. A Gentile questioned Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. He was one of our heroes in one of our courses this year. He questioned him saying, these things that you Jews do appear to be a kind of sorcery. It looks like magic. A red heifer is brought, it is slaughtered, it is burned, pounded into ash, its ash is gathered up. Then one of you gets defiled by contact with a corpse. Two or three drops of the ash mixed with water are sprinkled upon him, and he is told, poof, you are cleansed. This is sorcery. I'm not going to ask the questions until we reach the end of this text. He, Rabban Yochanan, said to him, has the spirit of madness ever possessed you? The man says, no. Have you ever seen a man whom the spirit of madness has possessed? Someone else, not you? Oh, yes, I've seen that. Rabban Yochanan said to him, and what do you do for such a man? What's your system? He said, oh, roots are brought. The smoke of their burning is made to rise about him. They burn the roots of some branches. Water is sprinkled upon him, and the spirit of madness flees. That's what we do. Rabban Yochanan said to him, do not your ears hear what your mouth is saying? It is the same with a man who is defiled by contact with a corpse. He too is possessed by a spirit, the spirit of uncleanness, tum'ah in Hebrew. As scripture says, what is he going to prove from the scripture? That spirit and uncleanliness are the same thing. For Zechariah says, I will cause false prophets and the spirit of uncleanness to flee from the land. So we deal with unclean people, you do deal with people who have been possessed by a spirit, but we're both doing the same thing. When the Gentile left, his disciples, the rabbi's disciples, said to him, Master, him you put off with a reed. What does that mean, a reed? A flimsy answer. You put him off, you know, without a real deep answer. What is the answer you will give us? He replied, by your lives, I swear, neither does the corpse defile nor the water cleanse. What we do, you should know, the corpse does not render a person unclean, nor does the water cleanse a person. Rather, it is the decree of the Holy One. The Holy One, blessed is he, said, I have set it down as a statute. I have issued it as a decree. And you are forbidden to transgress my decree. This is the statute of Torah. It's the end of the story. Now, I have a lot of questions to ask. Let's go back to the text. The Gentile asks, what? These things that you would do seem to be sorcery. What's bothering the Gentile? Does the Gentile believe in sorcery or doesn't he believe in sorcery? Wait a minute. What do you say? You say he does. What do you mean? No, this is a story from the first centuries, right? Yeah. Well, wait a minute. Wait, he doesn't see himself doing sorcery, or he doesn't see the Jews doing sorcery?
No, he sees the Jews doing sorcery.
Ah, in other words, he's a scientist. What we do is science. What you do is magic. In other words, what you're saying is that, according to that suggestion, that the Gentile is a scientist, he comes from the university, and he's attacking the Jews. You guys are doing hocus pocus, we do science. What I do with the branches and the smoke, that's science. What you do with the water and the ashes, that's sorcery. That's according to your impression. Is there anyone who thinks that it might be a different, there might be a different approach to the story? Does the rabbi, what is bothering the Gentile? Yes.
Maybe he's wondering why they don't just use the same method that he used.
Well, this is uncleanness and that's demons. System.
System that is more common to
the... Oh, everybody has his own system. Any other possibility? Yes.
The ash of the heifer. Or actually,
I can't hear.
The ash and the burnt heifer basically is alkaline. So it would be a form of soap, lye. Mixing it with water would create something with which
so you're explaining the process. I asked another question here. I asked, what is bothering the Gentile that he asked this question? Something brought about that he would ask the question. What's bothering him? And he seems, I mean, I think you noticed, is it a question he's asking or is it a challenge? It sounds like a challenge. You Jews do something, and it looks like sorcery. It seems to be a challenge. Yes?
He must have run into some Jews who told him that they're better than he is.
Ah, that we don't do sorcery. In other words, that's not what we heard from before. According to what you're suggesting is, the Gentile admits we do believe in magic, but we've heard that you Jews claim that you don't believe in magic, but I will pin you down and prove what? You're doing the same thing. You're doing magic. You're no better than us. So that's another way of explaining it. In other words, yes, please. Yeah, but then the language is these things you do appear to be a kind of sorcery. In other words, that seems to bother him one way or another, right? It doesn't say, would you please tell me how you guys get rid of an uncleanliness, right? He doesn't ask to be taught. He seems to be challenging. He seems to be almost scoffing. You do this, you do this, and then you call him clean and he's clean. Poof. I could tell jokes about this, but not now, right? If we have time. Yes, one more suggestion. Very brief. You're a hypocrite, right? That's what this person said, right? You're a hypocrite. You claim you're not doing it, but you are doing it. So there are different ways of explaining this. We've seen at least two or three different approaches here. Okay, now let me ask you a second question. Does Yochanan ben Zakkai really answer the question?
No.
Does he? No. What does he do? He answers the question with a question. And is his question really a response? I mean, it's a response, obviously. But does it answer the challenge of, from Yochanan ben Zakkai's answer, does it emerge that what the Jews do is not sorcery? He says, let your ears hear what your mouth is saying, right? So basically, Yochanan ben Zakkai seems to be answering by doing what? By saying, you're right. It's just what you do. What isn't Yochanan ben Zakkai saying? What could he have said? He could have said, you think it's sorcery. Why? And this is maybe what that gentleman said before, but I wouldn't go in your direction. I would take it in another direction. I would have expected the rabbi to say, you think it's sorcery because you don't understand what? That there's an inner meaning to this procedure. There's some sort of a mystical, inherent, right? There's, or allegorical meaning, and you only see the what? You only see the outer elements, pouring water and a cow and burning. He doesn't try to say that God really knows that there's an internal meaning here. He doesn't say that, does he? He simply says, we're doing something very similar to what you're doing. And now, of course, the question is, so does Yochanan ben Zakkai believe in the procedure that the Gentile does? What do you think? How do you know? He says it's the same thing. There's a problem here. What is this dialogue? Where is this dialogue taking us? Yes. Wait a minute.
However, yeah. He does not accept the fact that God told the Gentiles to burn birds and strip the water.
Is he being disingenuous with the Gentile?
I don't think so. I think he's bringing it to a level where he believes the Gentile can understand.
Okay, we'll get to that in a second. That's an interesting approach. You say he's not being... Okay, yes. Yes, you wanted to say something. Wait a minute, you're answering a question that I haven't asked yet. I only asked to limit yourself to the discussion between Yochanan. My question does not relate to the end of the story yet. All I said was, what does his answer say? What does he say to the Gentile? What is he implying when he says to the Gentile what he says? Does he imply that he agrees with the Gentile, that he doesn't agree with the Gentile? Does it imply that he believes that what he is doing is magic? Does it imply that what the Gentile is doing is magic? That's all I asked, and I heard a few answers that were all very good. Huh? Okay. We'll remember that. Now, one last question. When the Gentile left, his disciples asked him, Master, him you put over the reed, what do you say to us? And Yochanan says, I've got news for you. The corpse doesn't defile. The water doesn't cleanse. It's God's decree. Does this answer cancel out the first answer? It's a different answer, right? And the first answer the disciples called what? A reed. Give us the real answer. And so he supposedly gives the real answer, not the reed. So what happens now to the reed? How am I, the reader of this text, supposed to relate to the first answer that was given? I'm a Jew. What should my attitude now be towards the first answer? The disciples called it a reed, and sure enough, Yochanan gave them another answer. What does that seem to suggest regarding the first answer? That it is? Say what you're doing with your head, right? That it's not accurate, the first answer. If that's the case, or it's not the whole truth. That's maybe a nicer way of saying it. But if it's not the whole truth, then I have a problem. Why do I have to know it? Why does the Midrash supply me with answers that are not the whole truth? Is the Midrash suggesting that I should give answers that are not the whole truth to Gentiles? And I should only give the truthful answers to my Jewish students? Got a problem here. And you see why I'm asking you questions, and I want you always to answer with your gut reaction. I don't want to give you too much time to think. It's no good. It's not healthy, right? Because the Midrash works on impressions. The Midrash knows that if you think about it, you may change your mind, and it's playing with us here. So let's be very brief. Yes?
The truth would not be good for the Gentile to hear.
So what you're saying is the truth would not be good for the Gentile to hear, so I impart something that is not the truth. Is that the message? You realize what you're saying? I mean, think about it. Since it won't be good for the Gentile, don't tell him the truth.
No, it won't be good for the Jew.
Okay, we'll get to that. I like that answer. So the Gentile is a child.
Not necessarily, but he hasn't got the same background as the disciples do.
But do we give a child...
No, it's not that it's not truthful.
But it's not the whole truth. I gave a lecture here once where I said that to give a half-truth is a problem. I used to remember when I was a child and... You know, I grew up in a very Orthodox neighborhood. And I would see these guys riding motorcycles on Shabbat. And I remember my father used to always tell me, they're doctors. and then I remember, I mean, you can guess that very often on the back seat there was a woman. Nurses, right? And this went on. So this is what you told a child, right? Now, it's not an untruth. Doctors are permitted to ride on the Sabbath, and nurses are permitted to ride on the Sabbath. I don't know if I would call that a truth or not, right? In other words, he wasn't imparting a lie by telling me that doctors are allowed to ride on the Sabbath. That particular guy with the leather jacket may not have been, right? I want to really continue, so maybe just one more response.
I just wanted to say that he answered the question that he was asked. The Gentile didn't ask him, tell me the whole truth about this process. He asked him a particular question, and he gave a particular...
Okay, question. But and it did not satisfy the student.
A different question as a follow-up.
Well, are they asking a different question? No, they're asking the same question. They are saying the answer you gave him... They're not saying we have another question... They're saying the answer you gave him is a reed. What do you tell us? Not what do you tell us about a second question. About that question.
But their question came out of the answer that he gave to the Gentile. It's not exactly like they asked the same question.
No, they are relating to the answer that he gave the Gentile. I agree with you. But it's not a derivative. It's not derived. The Gentile asked a question. The rabbi answered an answer. Okay? That satisfied the Gentile. But the disciples say, we're very sorry. That does not satisfy us. Oh, exactly. That's the point. In other words, so now my problem is, if it, they ask, yeah, excellent. I agree with you. In other words, his question is, do they ask for more or do they ask for something different? I don't know. What is what they're getting, something more or something different?
More deeper.
I mean, it's easy to say more deeper. Is it more or is it different? To the Gentile, he said, what I do is what you do. To the students, he said, you have to understand. No, I'm sorry, you didn't get a point that I made. What did he say before to the Gentile? Just as you get rid of a spirit, that's how we get rid of uncleanness. To the disciples, he says, there's no such thing as uncleanness. I'm sorry. He didn't say there's an inner meaning to what we do. It's not quite the same thing. You got to be very careful with these texts. Okay.
But we're forgetting the end of his answer on 6.
Yeah, which is?
Quotes scripture.
Yeah, that proves that uncleanness and spirit are the same thing. The spirit of uncleanness. The Gentile dealt with spirits, right? How do you move an evil spirit? Right. By the way, I want you to notice something very interesting. There's one superfluous line here, and I'm interested that nobody caught the superfluidity, I don't know, of the line. If you look at, what is this issue of, he said, have you ever seen a man? I'm sorry, has the spirit of madness ever possessed you? And he says no. And then he says, have you ever seen another man that it's possessed? And he says yes. Why do I need that little dialogue there? Isn't that really meaning? I mean, what does it add to the story? You notice that it's kind of, what is this? It's a very interesting line. I'm going to suggest that it's a very important line. That might even be the key to the whole story. Or at least a part of the story. Yes?
Well, the first question is, are you nuts?
No. It isn't.
Do you believe in that?
No. That's your interpretation. It's legitimate, right? But it's not what it says. The question is, has the spirit ever possessed you? No. Has it possessed somebody else? Yes. What is this? What does that imply? Yes, please.
Is he asking the question to the rabbi about himself, or is he trying to find the information out for another person?
The rabbi is responding. He asked about the cow, the red cow. The rabbi answers the question with a question, and the question is, have you ever been possessed? The Gentile says, no. Have you seen somebody else possessed? He says, yes. That little interchange is very interesting. Why? Why couldn't he have... Yes?
It seems to put the man on the defensive. It kind of throws it back at him. It sets on his footing. And it also makes one think, well, if he had ever been, touched by madness, that he would know about the efficacious.
Yeah, we're having trouble today here. It's getting late, I know. I don't know. Maybe. Put the question on hold, okay? Just remember that question.
It's always easy to see something.
Ah, excellent. Remember that. That's very good. Very good. What she said is, there's something very interesting. People don't see things on themselves. They see things on others. And if the storyteller made that point, he seems to be suggesting that's an important point here, that people see things on others that they don't see about themselves. Remember that logic. You know what? I would I'd like to go to the second story. And you'll see in a moment why I chose it. Hadrian, may his bones crumble to dust, He's the Roman emperor, and he's the Roman emperor who put down the Bar Kokhba War, persecuted Jews, a bad person, although the Romans loved him. Asked Rabbi Joshua ben Hananiah, saying, by the way, who of you have the Hebrew version? You have the Hebrew. No, some people got the Hebrew version. A few of them, asked who are those people who read Hebrew. Notice the language of the question in Hebrew. The first story. Goy echad sha'al et Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai amar lo. The switch is very interesting. A Gentile asked Rabbi Yochanan by telling him. What is the point? Is it a question or is it a statement? Look at the beginning of the second story. Right? The story we're about to begin. Adrianus sha'al et Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananiah amar lo. Hadrian asked Rabbi Joshua by telling him. All of these stories all begin in a very interesting way. It appears as an innocent question, and then it changes the language to be what? A statement. And there's a major difference between asking a question and making a statement. By the way, since we are only 5 weeks away from Pesach, when you get to the Seder, you remember the four sons we talk about? And everybody always loves to ask, why is the second son better than the first? Both of them seem to be excluding themselves. The first son says, what are these things that you do? Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem. And the second son also says, right? Ma ha'davar hazot lachem. What are these things you do? But it's very interesting. The first son, if you look at the scripture from where that is quoted, it says, if your children should ask you, v'haya ki yish'alcha bincha, if your son should ask you in the future, this is what you answer. The scripture that the second son uses for his question begins, v'haya ki yomru aleichem b'nechem, if your sons shall tell you. The first son, the good son, is asking a question. The second son is making a statement. Now here, in all of the questions are statements. Sha'al Amar. Now, let's read the story. It's a challenge. The Holy One, blessed be He. I really should have given this talk in a synagogue. Why? I need the Ten Commandments in back of me. I need the tablet with five things and another tablet with another five things. I'm not sure that that's the way the tablets actually looked at Sinai. We think they didn't look like that, with circular on the top, but that's another problem. The Holy One, blessed be He, bestowed a great honor upon the nations of the world, meaning the Gentiles. God respected the Gentiles more than He did you. Why? When He gave the first five commandments to Israel, because the first five commandments, certainly the first four, but even the fifth, the rabbis would imagine, are uniquely Israeli, right? What do they talk about? Huh? Right, things you can do with God, which clearly the pagans, it's not relevant to pagans. The pagans, what is relevant to the pagans? The second five, not to kill, not to steal, right, not to covet, and so on and so forth. The first five were given to Israel, he says, but you'll notice, when he gave the first five commandments to Israel, he involved his name in the commandments. God's name appears in the first five commandments. It doesn't appear in the second five. So what does Hadrian say? He messed you up by putting his name in the first commandments that he gave you because he doesn't like you. And as a result, what? So that if Israel sins, God raises a cry against them. His name is in the commandments that he gave you. So if you don't keep them, he will be offended. Whereas with us, but in the second five commandments that he gave to the nations of the world, his name is not involved. So that when the nations of the world sin, he does not raise a cry against them. Very strange question. In other words, God likes us, so he kept his presence out of the commandments he gave us, so as not to be offended if we don't keep them. It's an interesting question, statement. What does Rabbi Joshua do? Rabbi Joshua replied, let's take a walk in the city. Now, I don't know if you noticed, it's like the first story. In the first story, did Yochanan ben Zakkai answer, or what did he do? He asked a question. Here, too, you don't get an immediate answer. What do you get? Let's go for a walk about the city square with me. In each and every place where Joshua led him, Hadrian would see a statue of himself set up. And Rabbi Joshua asked, "Who is this?" You know, I'm sure Hadrian, the first time he asked the question, he probably stood near the statue. You know, "Don't you see the resemblance, right?" And Hadrian said, "It's a statue of me." "And this one, who is it?" he replied, "It's a statue of me." Until he brought him to the privy, till he brings him to the local public toilet. And then he says to Hadrian, "My lord king, I see that you are ruler everywhere in the city and your statue," it's going to be statute, right? "Statue is everywhere, but here you're not set up. Why no statue here?" Hadrian answers. The Hebrew is kind of cute. The Hebrew is, "Are you the guy that the Jews call smart? Are you a sage among the Jews? Would such be an honor due a king that a statue of him be set up in a place that is loathsome, a place that is repulsive, a place that is filthy? Of course there's no statue of me in this horrible place, the public toilet, because it's a filthy place." You realize now what the problem is. Rabbi Joshua said, "Do not your ears hear what your mouth is saying." You notice what's happening in these stories. It's the same formulae. The same sentences appear here. That's why I think that's a connection between the different stories. "Don't you hear what you're saying? Is it fitting for the glory of the Holy One, blessed be he, that his name be mentioned with murderers, with adulterers, with thieves?" Why did he keep his name out of the last five? Because just as you don't want your statue, right, near the public toilet, he doesn't want his statue, his name, near the thieves and the murderers. The emperor went away. Actually, in Hebrew, he doesn't dismiss him. Now, I would imagine that at first when Hadrian heard this answer, he was rather happy. "Gee, I'm just like God, right? I don't have my statue in a filthy place, and God doesn't put his name in a filthy place." And then he started walking away, and then he said, "Hey, wait a minute. What did he just tell me, right? That we're the filthy people that he doesn't want his name among." In other words, right? That's why he doesn't put his name in the last five. When he left, when the emperor left, the disciples said to Rabbi Joshua, "Master, him you dismissed with a reed, what answer do you give us?" There's a little trickery here. And again, did Joshua really answer the question? Huh? Well, he did and he didn't. What do you give us? What answer do you tell us? And what is the rabbi's answer? He said to them, "This is what came into the mind of the Holy One, blessed be he." Meaning what? What does it remind you of? The first story. This is what God decided. Don't ask questions. Now there's a continuation here that doesn't really belong, and I'm not going to read it. Well, I can read it. But it doesn't really belong to the story. In fact, it contradicts the story. It was brought here by later redactors who attached one Ten Commandments story with another Ten Commandments story. It's a well-known story that God at first, you know the story, I'm sure, he went to the different nations. He went to the sons of Asa and he said, "Will you accept my Torah?" And they said to him, "Master, what is written?" And he told them, "You shall not kill." And they said, "This goes against our grain. Our father, you know, we have to kill. That's our livelihood." Then he goes to the sons of Ammon and they ask him, "What does it say? Thou shalt not commit adultery. We're sorry. We live an adulterous life." The sons of Ishmael, "Thou shalt not steal," and so on and so forth. And then, of course, he came to the Israelites, and what did they answer? He asked them, "Do you receive my Torah?" And what did they answer? Na'aseh v'nishma, sight unseen. The rabbi at Beth Israel this week spoke about that in the sermon. I was listening, right? Last week. Yeah, this week. Na'aseh, we sight unseen. You all know there's another version to the same story. Yes, of course. He asked the Israelites, "Will you accept my Torah?" And they asked, "How much does it cost?" And the answer was, "It's free." "Well, if it's free, we'll take two," right? And so they have the two tablets, or Torah Shebichtav, or Torah Shebaltei, any way you want. But of course, this story really contradicts the first story, because here it suggests that they didn't receive the last five commandments. Dafka, the last five commandments, they say they cannot keep, whereas in the first story, they do keep the first. But you notice how the story repeats itself again. The Gentile makes a challenge, a question which is a challenge. The rabbi answers the Gentile what he answers. The Gentile goes off, and then the students say, but what is the real reason? What is the real answer? And he says, this is what God decided. Let's go to the third story. This story is slightly different, but it really fits into the same pattern. The answer is different. Rabbi Elasa said, a Gentile asked Rabbi Joshua, saying, you notice the same language again, asked, saying, it is written in your Torah, this is a real challenge, it's an interesting challenge. It is written in your Torah, acharei rabim lahatot, you must always follow the majority, incline after the many. But we, Gentiles, are more numerous. Actually, somebody in the audience asked me a very similar question today. One of you asked me this question about 40 million French can't be wrong, right? It says, incline after the many, that majority rules. We are more numerous than you. Why do you not become like us in respect to idolatry? If there is a principle in the Torah that the minority must always give in to the majority, well, we're the majority. So why don't you join our idolatrous world? Interesting question. Rabbi Joshua said to him, do you have sons? Again, steers him away from the question to something else. Do you have children? The Hebrew is beautiful here. His answer is, Amarlo, hizkartani tzarati. You've reminded me of my tzoris. In fact, I must tell you, every time I read this story, I have serious doubts about the Gentile pedigree of this guy. His answer sounds slightly too Jewish, right? You know the story about the two Jewish ladies sitting in the park, right? And they haven't spoken for 3 hours. They're just sitting there, sitting there, sitting there. And finally, one of them lets out what we used to call a krecht, right? Hi. And her friend says, I thought we decided not to speak about the children today. Right, so, you know, you reminded me of my trouble. The rabbi asked, why? What's your trouble? He told him, when they sit at my table, one blesses this god, the other that god. They do not rise from the table until they have cracked each other's skulls. They get into a violent fight about who the right deity is. He said, the rabbi continued, and do you bring agreement among them? Do you try to make one agree with the other? He replied, no. He said, well then, before you make us agree with you, go and bring about agreement among your children. Now you have to understand what the problem is here. What annoys the Jew? I'm sorry, what annoys the Gentile in this story? Not that there are different types of polytheistic beliefs within the Gentile world. What bothers him, and that's the beginning of the story, that the Jew doesn't belong to that world. He's odd man out. So it's not that he doesn't like diversity, because he lives in a diverse world. But diversity stops at the door of the Jew, because when the Jew is diverse or otherly, that's already what? That in the Greco-Roman world is unacceptable. That is real otherness. And if there's one thing the Greeks were afraid of, it's that type of otherness. So he was rebuffed and he went away. His disciples said to him, Master, him you dismissed with a reed. What answer do you have for us? You see how these things, constantly the same type of story. He said, I will not leave you empty. I have an answer for you. And the answer goes to the heart of what does it mean to be majority and what does it mean to be minority. Regarding Esau, it says in the Bible, six souls. He had six people in his family that are mentioned by Scripture, and yet the word used of them is souls in the plural. For it is written, and Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the souls of his house. But we only know of six people in his house. of Jacob, I'll explain this in a minute. Of Jacob, on the other hand, we know there were 70 souls that went down to Egypt with him, right? I added that. And yet the word used of them in Scripture is the singular soul. Shivim nefesh yardu mitzrayima. Not nefashot, not plural. Even though he's much more. So 70 are, he uses for 70 what? The singular form. And for six, he uses the plural. Why? In the case of Esau, who worshipped many deities, Scripture uses souls, many. Jacob, who did not worship many deities, only one soul is written. And all the nefesh, singular, that came out of the loins of Jacob, 70 nefesh. Okay, what is the point here? The point is rather simple. When do we say that majority rules and the minority must accept the opinion of the majority? When the majority themselves are what? Unified. But when the majority itself, when the unity of the majority is really what? A facade. But when you scrape at the surface, what do you find? That that majority is really what? Many different groups. Then it's not majority versus minority. And in fact, right, we can look at ourselves as being a majority because we are one. We are unified. Okay, so this is another answer. Now I want to ask all of the questions. Now I have the real questions. So we thought, what did we see? We saw three examples where a Gentile asks a question. The rabbi answers the Gentile in a very oblique manner. And in all three cases, it is not sufficient for the students. The students want another answer and they get another answer. You'll notice that in all three cases, or first, certainly the first two cases, does the rabbi really answer the disciples? Does he really give an answer? What does he say? That's what God wanted. Even the third answer, if you examine it later on at home, you'll find it doesn't really answer the question that well. But of course, what interests me is the fact that there is a different answer given to a Gentile and a different answer given to a Jew. And I ask very simply again, I repeat what I asked before, is that the path of Torah? That you give one answer to the Gentile and one answer to the Jew. Are there two truths? One second. Yes, please, briefly, because I don't want, if it moves me out of the... Yes.
And I think it's a similar thing. I think this idea that 70 people have a unified ideology is like the majority. And I think what the rabbis are doing, and what Christians might do when they know you're a Jew, is to find the commonality. You get along.
Who might do it? I don't understand. Who's looking for the common element?
Well, the story is the rabbi.
Yeah. But I don't see that in the story here. Yeah, but I'm talking still about the story. The story, the question I asked was, does this story at face value not seem to impart a message that might be troublesome to us? And that is, you give one answer to a Gentile, another answer to the students. On the simple level, on the superficial level, that might be troubling to some of us. Because that's what you read at first glance. And not only that, they actually belittle the answer that the rabbi gave the Gentiles. They call it a reed. See, my question is, did the students really understand what the rabbi was doing? But the students called it a reed. In other words, what you gave this Gentile is, it's lacking. It's a reed. It's not a real complete answer. Something's missing there.
But these were not good questions. These were statements almost like...
Challenges, you mean?
Yes.
But still.
In your face, so the rabbi just...
In other words, what you're saying is, you're repeating my question as a statement. Yes, he dismissed the Gentile. He's not worthy of a real answer. In other words, you're saying, this is what I have to do with... Gentile doesn't deserve a real answer. Okay. Yes. Now, by the way, I want to make my question even clearer before I ask you. You noticed that at least in the first two stories, the rabbi really didn't have an answer, right? Could it be that he's simply embarrassed to tell the Gentile, I don't know?
Yeah.
Whereas to the students, he doesn't have that compunction. He's not, I mean, how many times can you say, I don't know? Right? Okay. Yes, you wanted to say something.
In all three stories, the Gentile tries to invalidate, discredit.
Yes.
And in all three stories, the rabbi gives the answer that it's more or less, we're like you.
Yes. Okay. That sounds two-faced to me. In other words, what you're saying is he's embarrassed to say to the Gentile, or he's not willing to say to the Gentile, we're unique. He's only willing to say that to his disciples. Is that what you said?
I'd say we live in a real world.
So you're telling me the Midrash is saying we live in a real world and you can't always say the whole truth to outsiders. That's kind of depressing if that's the case. I'm going to suggest an answer that'll make it a little easier. It'll make it a little easier to accept, okay? Slightly. But let me continue because we're really going to sidetrack. You are correct in one point you made, which is very important. And I want to begin with this. In all the examples we saw, what does the rabbi do as a response to the question? He holds up a mirror. And he says, look at yourself. You're asking me about things that you yourself do. This is a very important statement. Why? Because in the Hellenistic world and Roman world, what was the major attack against Jews? And I even alluded to it before in the dinner that we had here. You're different. You are distinguished by what? By your difference. I can just read one line out of Tacitus, the greatest of Roman historians. Moses introduced new religious practices quite opposed to those of all other religions. The Jews regard as profane all that we hold sacred. On the other hand, they permit all that we abhor. In other words, what are the Jews? The exact opposite of us. They sit apart at meals, they sleep apart, and although as a race they are prone to lust, I don't know what he's talking about here, but... No. They abstain from intercourse with foreign women. They adopted circumcision to distinguish themselves from other peoples by this difference. They are different, different, different. And when you put it into this context, the rabbinic response that constantly repeats itself is, you're asking me about Jewish behavior without even realizing what, and you constantly say how different we are. Look at yourself. And people are not always capable of looking at themselves. That's why I said that in that first story, that little line, has a madness ever taken over you? And he says, no, has it ever taken over somebody else? Oh, yes, I've seen it with others. People see phenomena with others, but don't realize that it may have happened to them. And here the story is, you see how we Jews behave and you do not realize that you do it also. Now, we haven't solved everything yet. If that's the case, right, why don't the students like it? Why don't they like that answer? Why is it a read? What's the problem with that answer? There's a problem with that answer, a serious problem. Maybe somebody who hasn't answered yet?
It's not an answer, it's an attack.
The answer is very simple. Gentile is right, and we all basically do the same things. W- What's bad with that answer? Who, what type, yes, characterize that answer. Where would you expect to receive an answer, yes, these people remove impurity in this fashion, in this type of hocus pocus, and these people do it in this type of hocus pocus, and so on. Where would you expect to learn about such phenomenon? Philosophers, I'm not sure. Today, where would you learn about this? In what? In a course on comparative religion, anthropology, right? In Guinea, Papua Guinea, they do it this way, and in this country, whatever, but they're basically all doing the same thing with slight variations. The answer that the rabbi gives the Gentile is what? We all do it in one or another variation, but we're all really very similar, because that's the nature. That's the nature of the human race. And we are all partners in the human race. Which, of course, as we saw, is exactly the opposite of what Tacitus says. But why are the students uncomfortable with that answer? Because who does it remove from the equation? God. If you start dealing with practices as what? Anthropological interpretation. You are basically saying what? There's nothing divine in anything we do. We're all really behaving in a human way, the way other tribes do it, with slight variance. And so what does the rabbi tell the disciples? Why do we do it? Now comes my question. So we do it because God commanded. Now comes my question. Does that answer negate the answer to the Gentile? You see my question here? Does it mean that the answer to the Gentile was a dishonest one? Not necessarily. And this is the greatness of the answer. One second, please. The rabbis are saying something very impressive here. We are all part of the same human race. Genetically, racially, there's absolutely no difference. And as a result, we all have the same behavioral instincts. And so to the Gentile, he answered in an honest way. We have the same behavioral instincts. We all do the same things. To the disciples, that, of course, is not a sufficient answer because they're looking for God. But what does he answer? He says, yes, we have the same basic instincts that everybody else on this planet has. What do we do with those instincts? We channel them. We make them subservient to what? To God's command. We don't keep God's commands because we are a super race. We're like everyone else. But we want to raise the level of our behavior and look at it as what? As a commandment of God. I'll give you a simple example to compare it. Maimonides talks about sacrifices in his famous Guide to the Perplexed. And you know what he says? Why were sacrifices given to the Israelites? Come on, you burn an animal to worship God. And you have to do it with all sorts of little techniques. Does God care? Could God care? And his answer is brilliant. He says, of course God doesn't care. That's the way people in the ancient world understood worship. And as such, Jews were no different from Gentiles. But what does God do? He takes that human nature and he asks you to do what? Channel that human nature to my command, to my request. In other words, what the Jews are saying is, we have all the instincts that you have, the basic instincts, if you want, all of the human fears and weaknesses. But what do? We want to look at them as part of what? Of God's, in other words, God is using those basic instincts. And he says, I know you have an urge to do sorcery. Do it this way. Not because there's anything internal in it. In other words, Yochanan is very correct in not giving it an allegorical interpretation. Oh, you don't understand the inner meaning. There is no inner meaning. But if you do what you do, burning that cow because God, you think that God commanded you to do it, and thereby what are you doing? You are giving, as it were, some expression to the basic needs of every human being. You are now becoming what? A servant of God. And this is brilliant. You know what it reminds me of? A very interesting midrash. Do you remember that after every day that God created something in the world, what does it say? And God saw, ki tov, it's good. On the last day, the sixth day, what does it say? Tov me'od, very good. And the Midrash asks, what is very good? And the answer it gives is very strange. What is very good? That is, it's very interesting. The Midrash says this as follows. Tov, good. That's Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination. What is very good? That's the evil inclination. Yetzer, Matrix, huh? The evil inclination is very good? How can that be? And the answer the Midrash gives is yes. Without the evil inclination embedded in every human being, a man would not marry and not have children, and not have a house, not build a house, not go into business, which is brilliant. Why do we do it? Why do we marry? Because we really think that the world needs children. We have to multiply the world. No! We marry for very base reasons and very, very basic instinct. And that's the Yetzer Hara, right? And what does God say when he creates man? That's Tov Me'ot. I like that. That these Jews can look at their most basic instincts, the instincts that they share with all of humanity, and say, what? We're channeling it because God says, be multiple, multiply and be fruitful, pru'urvu, right? As if that's why we have sexual relations, to keep the mitzvah. And you see what's happening. This is why I like these stories. Because these stories may, in fact, have a very, very deep message to them. And the message is, come down from your high horse. You're no different from anybody else in this world. The only difference is that you are willing to use those instincts that you share with everyone else, and you're willing to follow, to somehow direct them towards God's commandment. And it gives a whole new meaning to these stories, I think. Now, I have one little additional comment, and then I will end. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy. This issue of you do it too, that the rabbi used, you can use in these discussions between Jews and Gentiles. Never use it with your spouse. If your spouse accuses you of doing something, either apologize, but don't say you do it also. It does not work in marital relations. I am talking from long experience, right? And I remember when I came across this interpretation of these midrashim, my wife was with me for the first time. And for years we used to say, you do it too, to one another. And that, of course, always led to a bigger fight, right? And so somehow it works only in Jewish-Gentile discourse, but not, you know, outside the family, but not in the family. I'll leave it at that. If there are questions, I'll be happy. Okay.